Mr. Jewett, reel 8. The Phoebe was a brand new vessel, I think you said.
Brand new, Dido class cruiser.
What size and...
About 5,000 tons.
Complement, etc.
About 5,000 tons. And I think the complement would be about 550, I think, something like that. She carried 8 5.25s, which were the very latest guns in twin mountings. There were four twin mountings, and they had one QF AA 4-inch QF anti-aircraft gun. That was she should have had 10 5.25, but they made an extra cruiser and they took the guns off some of the crews off one of them. They had three turrets forward, but they made it two, and they changed it so that they could have the guns for an extra, because these 5.25s were exceptionally good guns. They it was the first time I didn't know much about gunnery then, but I realised later on that it was the ammunition system, supply system for the magazines, which were down in the ship going up to the turrets, was done by a very recent that hadn't been used before, by what is known as a pusher hoist. Now the pusher hoist in the magazines, they put a shell up, and all the hoist does was go up about 12 14 inches or so and then come back again, and pushes the shell up, but it doesn't actually go on a row as previously. They always went on an endless chain, like a chain that went round and round and round, and you just put it on the chain. And the chain used to go round and round and round and from the magazine to the gun turret, and the man in the gun turret took it off and put it in the shell. So, whereas in the magazine, they put the shell onto it. But the pusher hoist, they just put it onto the hoist, and up, it used to just push it up and up and up and up, and it used to come out the top of the into the gun turret. So that was a very innovative. They were very modern ships. They were very fast. They were fast, like overgrown destroyers. Really, they were twice the size of a destroyer.
I was going to ask you, when does a destroyer change from destroyer to cruiser?
Well, a destroyer. Nowadays, there's an intermediary called a frigate, but they didn't have them then. Remember, a destroyer, which I was on later. The proper name was torpedo MTB destroyers. They were built to destroy torpedo boats. That's what they were for, originally. And they were originally about 1,000 tons, but they got bigger and bigger until the Ashanti and Matchless and big modern ships were about 1,800 tons. They were quite big things. But when you talk about cruisers, I think the smallest cruisers there are something like about 4,000 tons, which is twice the size of it. You know, it's quite a hefty thing, you see. And but very, very, very efficient. They had their place. They were very fast, actually. Did about 30,
I was going to ask you what speed it would do.
The Phoebe did something about 33 knots or something like that.
And what torpedo capacity did this?
Well, they carried 8 torpedoes, yes, they had it. But they were on the upper deck, you know. The torpedo tubes were on either side on the upper deck. And whereas on a destroyer, small ship, they're on the centre line of the ship. We only had 4 on these. Yeah.
The armoured protection, deck protection, what kind of thickness?
Negligible. It's probably about 1/2 inch steel. Mm. Quite negligible, actually. It was built for speed and manoeuvrability rather than protection. There wasn't much in the way of protection at all. Well, from the weather, but that's about all. Anything came across you. They as far as shells and things like that, there was negligence. There was no underwater protection or anything.
How was the mail situation organised? Because obviously you can't send letters if you're at sea.
No, well, that's right.
You
had the ship's post office, you see, and you posted your letters, just the same as it was. And the ship's postman, who was usually a leading seaman, that was one of the perks of a Killick, usually a leading seaman, he used to get the mail, and it wouldn't be immediately sent off, because it would have to go through the warrant officer, through the wardroom, because the officers, as I told you, it was all hands in for the, they had to censor the mail, you see. And then it would go to the, from there it would go to the postman, who would batch it up, and then as soon as you went in port, into harbour, or wherever it was, Scapa or anywhere else, he'd take it immediately ashore and collect. They knew the ship was going to be there, and collect the incoming mail. But when I say censored, there was one, you were allowed, I think, one a month or something like that, letter which was a brown envelope, one envelope which was not censored, and you were allowed, you were on trust, and that was a brown envelope where you which was the one when you write to your love letter, you know, and all the bits and pieces what you'd like to do to her if you had a chance, sort of thing. And that was a concession that they made. And the address, I think, was the Fleet Mail Office for every HMS, whatever it was, Fleet Mail Office. That was all you got. Fleet Mail Office, somewhere or other, and that was it. There was no sort of address to send for the ship, you know. HMS Phoebe, Fleet Mail Office, and wherever that would get there.
What were the medical facilities on a
cruiser? You have a really good sick bay, as I'll come into that later. Where you'd have a petty officer, SBA, and a lieutenant, at least a lieutenant, who was a doctor, a lieutenant surgeon. He had a red between his rings, you know. And they were quite good, actually. They were very good, because lots of sailors got what means to get, what they call CDA, Cork Disease Ashore, you know. You can imagine what that is, you know, crabs and all sorts of weird and wonderful things sailors got when they went ashore, because they weren't all angels, you know, these were. But later on in life, I went into action. We haven't come to that yet. On the Phoebe, we went into action, and I did quite a few patrols, and then we bombarded off the coast of Norway, and I think it was Stavanger Airport. But you've got to remember that I was below decks, so I didn't see much of it, because I was in my action station, so you couldn't see a bloody thing. Like, you know, you can hear the guns firing, you know. But that's where we bombarded, and when we got back. What happened was, it's rather a strange thing. I got injured, if you like, rather than wounded in action. I mean, I can't sit here and say I was wounded in action. But the way I came off the Phoebe was because when we came back, we had all the shells, we had to re-ammunition ship. And we went into Greenock to re-ammunition. And that in re-ammunitioning ship, or ammunitioning ship, all the ship's company, I forgot to tell you this before, but in ammunitioning, all the ship's company, that regardless, except officers, regardless, whether that's cooks, stewards, officers, stewards, you name it, all supply assistants, everybody's all hands in. Now, a boy is respected on a ship because he knows more about things that go on than pretty well anybody else in the ship's company. And I was in charge of loading this ammunition from above to below into the magazine. And the magazine hatches had to be loaded, and the armoured hatches are about 2 inches, 2.5 inches thick armour. They weigh a ton over the top. And this, while we were ammunitioning, I had my feet astride, and some clown had removed the retaining chain on the hatch, this great big hatch weighing nearly half a ton. And I'm lowering away, and all with what they call a Weston's purchase. That's a piece of steel going round and round. It lowers these heavy things down into the magazine from the top. And I'm lowering away, and all of a sudden, bang! This thing came down on top of me. It was secured to the bulkhead, and then as the ship rolled, it was fine. But the ship rolled, you see, and probably the chain of the Western Purchase caught it and unhooked it, but down it came on top of me. Well, straight away I was out, straight away to the sick bay, and there was massive bruises. And the fact is, it didn't sever my foot, because there's a sharp steel surround for every hatch going down, and this thing had closed. And the reason was because the Western Purchase chain, which goes round and round, was made of steel, and there were these two chains were lying over the lip and stopped it from going, from severing. Otherwise my foot would have been chopped off like green. So that stopped it. So they humped me up to the sick bay, and the PO up there, they did what they could for me. I was conscious, but I was, you know, couldn't do very much. Pretty bad way, actually. And then all of a sudden, they had to go and collect all my gear, And they loaded all my gear into the Liberty boat, and I was taken off the ship. And I went from there into an emergency hospital near Glasgow called Mearnskirk Hospital at Newton Mearns in Glasgow, which was where it was just an emergency hospital. I think it had been a TB hospital in peacetime, but it had been made. And I went in there, and I was there for 6 weeks. And there, there was a very, very good doctor called Dr. Dale, and funnily enough, yeah, and he was a great doctor. And I learned to walk. They got me back on my feet again. And I was told that had it been peacetime, I'd have been invalided out of the Navy. There would have been no question about it, like, you know. But with it being wartime, they couldn't afford to lose a trained boy, see. So I lost the ship, and the ship sailed for them. That was why they took me off, you see, because they knew the ship was going. They'd got wind that the ship was going to the Med, and I'd have been a liability on the ship anyway.
The ship's doctor must have been able to turn his hand to almost any kind.
Everything, yeah, that's right. Amputation, you name it. They probably have special courses. I wouldn't know, but they are pretty good. And they're well respected, actually. The sore bones, yeah.
How did they look after the spiritual side of the ship's crew?
Oh yeah, well you had to have prayers, you know, divisions. You have to have prayers on the quarter deck. Everybody had to go there and sing these prayers, you know. The Roman Catholic and free church parties were always dismissed, so a lot of people changed their religion. All of a sudden, they didn't have to go. But do you know what they call the ship's chaplain? They have a chaplain, you see, and he looks over. Do you know what they call him? The Sin Bosun. It's a lovely name, isn't it? Sin Bosun. I know when I told Kit Widows, he's the master of St. Thomas's, I said, do you know what they call him? He went into fits. He said, that's typical Navy, you know, Sin Bosun. So there you are. Yes, they were looked after, and the boys, she's spiritual. I didn't tell you, but when I was at Shotley, we got religious instruction, Ari, and I was confirmed by the Bishop of Norwich. I don't know if I did tell you.
Yes, you did. We've got that.
Yeah. So, as I say, so your spiritual side was looked after, but I was now off the Phoebe now.
Did people could go to the padre or?
Oh yes.
Chaplain and talk of the property.
That's right. Private properties. Sometimes lads got a compassionate leave and things like that when their families were ill, or the children were ill, or the wife was playing away with the neighbour or something. You know, all sorts of compassionate reasons. Yeah. Oh yes. And he was a very powerful man in obtaining that. He would go to the captain, you see, whereas you couldn't go to the captain and say, look, my old woman's having it off with her. You know, but where's the padre could, you know, the chaplain, you know, he could. He was, there was a lot of help. They did a lot of good work. They're not supposed to fight the war, but they all did. You know, that pass the ammunition plays the Lord. They did. Everyone I knew did, anyway.
And you had a Sunday morning.
Yeah, that was Sunday divisions. Was when you had your prayers. Yeah, that's sort of off cap. And then the Royal Marine Band would be playing there. Not at sea, mind you. I'm not talking about not in the middle of the ocean. You know, I'm talking when you were in harbour. You know, in Scapa or in somewhere. But when one could, it was done. That was strict routine was ever done. You had to parade in your number ones. You know, in your best suits. You know, and everything was great. There was no getting down there in your overalls and. Leather sea boots, because they are leather sea boots, you know. It takes a long time to navigate them, actually, when you're on the steel deck. You don't know how what you're doing.
Who was captain of the ship?
A fellow called Otway Ruthven. I know it's a funny name to spell. Otway Ruthven. He was a four-ring captain, which he always is for a cruiser. It's always a four-ringer. And then you'd have the commander under him. I've forgotten his name. I can't remember them now all this way back. But I can remember his name, because he's on my... signed my papers, you see.
Did you see much of him?
Not a lot, no. I didn't see much of him either. The only time you ever saw the captain was either if you were in the rattle, or if you were going to be promoted, or if you'd done something marvellous or something, you know. Sort of.
I was going to ask you, how good was he as a captain?
Oh, everybody, no question about that. In the Navy, the old man, as he's irreverently called, is everybody's got faith in him. It's a bad job if you haven't. I mean, he's the man who takes you in. I mean, they used to play war about captains, because they would go into these places where there was lots of bloody fighting and things, you know. Couldn't they go somewhere nice and quiet? But no, everybody had great faith in the captain. Everybody did. He was, as far as we were concerned, as far as we knew, he was sort of the governor, you know.
Who was in charge of the boys?
Oh, nobody in particular. They didn't have a boys instructor.
You didn't have anyone, a lot of tea to look after?
No. It was all split up. We were all split up, you see. We were in different divisions. Some were top, some were... We were all split up. There was nobody specific. There might have been, but if there were, they would never saw them. So nobody really, as far as I know, were in charge of the boys.
Your memory of the officers and the senior people, were they good people? They weren't bullying...
No. No, they were most of them, except for, of course, the RNVR and the RNR who were called up. They were pretty good types, actually, from what would I mean. So some of them were probably looking back on it all these years. Some of them were probably a bit insecure themselves, you know, especially those that had been called into the Navy. You know, they'd been school teachers or something, and suddenly they found themselves commissioned officers in charge of a lot of men who knew a damn sight more about it than they did, you know, which must be somewhat embarrassing.
Do you recall any officer in particular that you did have a great deal more to do with?
No, not really. No, funnily enough, I can't. Not on the Phoebe. We're talking about the Phoebe. No, none at all. I had no particular affinity with anybody there.
Your own close comrades within yourself, any of those that stand out in your memory?
No, not really. One or two were a bit stroppy. They'd been on other ships and didn't know me, but I was never put upon in any way, shape or form when I was a boy. One of the most funny, amusing parts, I did know one person, a man called David Trevathan Thomas. Now, David Thomas was a funny lad. I'll tell you what happened. His father was a director of Shell Max. And David spoke with a posh accent. And I chummed up with him for some reason or other. And David Thomas, they wanted him to be an officer. And he refused, you see. Because he's one of these chaps who used to have a silk dressing gown with a dragon on the back. And I mean, we've seen them, I ask you. Well, anyway, David Thomas... I remember when there was a beautiful Rolls-Royce Phantom 3 came to go. We were in dock in Govan. We'd gone into dock to re-ammunition ship, and we got a week's leave, if I remember rightly. And when this Rolls-Royce came in with this liveried chauffeur, and we thought it was the captain's. We thought, oh, it's the old man, still, it must be, you know. And here David Thomas goes down the back. You know, we were going on leave, and he was carrying his bag, you know, his sailor's uniform, you know. He was just an ordinary seaman. And the chauffeur held the door open for David, and he gets in. And we were all aghast, because we were all coming down the back. We couldn't believe our eyes, you know, with this ordinary seaman getting into this Rolls-Royce car. And... David says, anybody want to lift to the station? Of course, there was a big rush to save going to the station. So you all go. And here the bold David was took the lads to... I never saw him after I left the Phoebe. I don't know whatever became of him, except the fact that he was a great lad. I hope he survived the war. he was quite a nice lad. Well-spoken, and he must have had... I think what happened was he was getting paid... anyway, from the company, and he probably didn't want any responsibilities. why should he? After all, if he was getting his money was being made up while he was in the service, why should he be an officer and have to work for it? You know, he had it right, and they couldn't get him to take a commission at all while I was there. Maybe he did afterwards. I don't know.
You went through all of the trials of this new vessel, I think you said.
Yes, I did, we did, yeah. And speed trials, gunnery trials, torpedo trials, you name it. Everything, yeah.
And when you first actually went to sea,
yeah,
in a serious business, do you recall when that was?
Yes, I do. It was the first time we went to sea was Atlantic convoys, for the early Atlantic convoys.
What dates would this be, you think?
God, I couldn't tell you that, not off the top of my head, no. I would have to get my books out, but they, you could easily look them, but you could easily check it up, because it's it'll be on the ship's log, you know, when they did these things. But the first time we went out, because cruisers always had a destroyer escort, you know, you didn't go out on your own. When a cruiser went out, there was about four or five destroyers went with it, because it had to, you know. And but we were a light cruiser. It wasn't a heavy cruiser. It was a light cruiser, and it was even half the size of the cruiser. Tom was on the Jamaica, you know, and Tom doesn't realise the Jamaica was about 9,000 tons. The Phoebe was a Dido, because it was about half the size of that. You know, it was a light cruiser, very fast. And but that's when we first went to see the Atlantic convoys covering force.
And what area were you covering?
Oh, we're going. Well, a cruiser would be sort of what they call covering force, would be the force to cover a convoy, you know, be maybe about 20 miles behind, well, not much of that, maybe 10, 15 miles behind the convoy, but covering it, you know, so that if there was a surface attack or anything like that, then in would go the covering force.
So a convoy would have its own escort?
Yes, close escort.
And then there was this covering force.
The covering force behind it. Yeah, they were all the cruisers and above. Like you wouldn't get cruisers and battleships in with the convoy ever. Not to my knowledge. You would get them covering force always behind, because it was a dangerous place to be in the convoy itself, because they got picked off. You know, they couldn't afford warships. I mean,
so you recall your first convoy?
No, I can't really. No, they, it's too clouded now, to be honest about that. I can't recall the first one. I just sort of, and remember, on the Phoebe, I was a very great disadvantage. Later on the Achante and the Vigilant, it was different, but on the Phoebe, I was in one of those action stations where I couldn't see a damn thing, you know. I was stuck in a room, and I was only there if I was needed, sort of thing, which is a bit of a nuisance. I mean, I can't sit here and tell you I saw this ship and that ship, but we were there, though, you know.
Where were the convoys flying to? Where were they going?
They were going from America, from north, from America and New York, across the Atlantic, to ports like Liverpool or Manchester, Liverpool or any of the ports on the Western Approaches, what they call the Western Approaches, you know.
Were the ships going out empty to America and then coming back?
Yes, that's right. Usually, and I presume they were. I should imagine so. There may have been two-way traffic. I wouldn't know, but
how did the process work? You would take a convoy out, the convoy ships out from England.
Well, we would meet. We would have a rendezvous, what they call a rendezvous point. You see, and we would pick a convoy up at a certain point. You see,
was that going out as well as coming in?
Coming in, yes, right, yeah. Because they would be escorted both ways. Because merchant ships are slow things. They only do, the best you can do is about 13, 14 knots, you know.
Was it this particular time when, whilst America wasn't in the war, she was beginning to provide escorts so far across?
I never saw any American ships, no. I didn't see any. But then again, remember the situation I was in. But I didn't see any American ships, but the Atlantic convoys were starting to get clobbered, you know, the convoys themselves. But we were, you couldn't do much when submarines. You see, destroyers and small destroyers like the Hunt class that came in later, they were the boys for those, really. They were just, they were.
You didn't get involved in any of these convoys, did you? Any actions at all?
No, not that I recall, no. Not that I recall, no. The main action we were in was bombarding off the coast of Norway, you know, when. We didn't get hit or anything because it was a one-way traffic walloping the airfields off Norway.
What kind of time would this be? Was this the time that of the Normandy invasion and actions?
Yes, it was. It would be about that time, somewhere around about 1941. Yeah, that's right. Because I commissioned the Ashanti in August. I'll have to get my papers out for you. I commissioned the Ashanti in August, and that would be. Around about July 41, so it's got to be, I'm trying to go through, maybe 1940, no, what am I talking about, 1940 this was.
And you were in this bombarding situation, obviously other ships as well.
Yes, that's right, yeah, that's right.
Had you become involved in any convoys going, probably a bit early, was it, going to Russia?
No, we hadn't come to that yet, that's right. Russia wasn't, hadn't got that sort of thing, that scene hadn't been organised yet, that was to come later on.
With the ship firing its guns, how does that affect the ship itself?
Oh, it doesn't really. The way it happens in a gun, when guns are fired, you have mercurial gun sight. Now, the guns are all fired by a director, by one person in the director. But how it always happens is that in actual, the way the guns are fired, they're fired by a director. But it's always fired. They're always fired when the ship is exactly level, because in the director layer has his finger on the trigger, and there's a mercury switch. And as soon as the ship gets onto the level position, the mercury switch is dead on, and it automatically fires all the guns. You see, although he's got his finger on the trigger, they don't fire. You know, the executive orders are given to fire the guns, but it's the mercurial switch that connects the circuit, which fires all the guns for the broadcast, broadside or salvo or whatever it is. So you get, even though the ship's rolling, it doesn't make an atom of difference. It's on a dead, steady platform when the guns are fired.
And if they fire particularly broadside, the ship does a good roll, does it? Does it affect it in that way?
Never noticed it. It probably does, but you don't notice these things. I never noticed, actually. You hear them, but you don't notice the recoil. It probably does a few degrees, but you wouldn't notice it, actually.